Well, it's good to see a crowd of people. We were supposed to be here in 2019. I just really want to apologize because my stuff was really tight in 2019. But I mean, I'm not sure what's going to come out. Start the timer. I just said I'd bring it up here. I didn't say this is to give you guys hope. I swear, you know, we got 2.5 hours tonight, and there'll be some breaks. And Katie says, you know, you can have the first hour. And then she says, it'd really be better if you took 45 minutes. And I said, how about 10? And then she goes, how about 7? 7 would be just right. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. My home group's a primary purpose group in Austin, Texas. We're a line-by-line big book study meeting. We meet on Tuesday nights at 2701 South Lamar at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday nights. If you're ever in Austin, we'd love for you to come see us. And a lot of people have. It's been really, really cool. And then we have a Zoom meeting that I'll get around to getting the Zoom. During the COVID thing, we went to a Zoom meeting. And it's, at one point, we had 600 people coming to the Zoom, and it's still over 300 generally, and it's a line by line. We study the big book line by line, week after week, and it's just a lot more fun than it sounds like. It's sometimes we only get like a paragraph, or especially with all these, the better the comments get, the better it's been. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and for that I'm truly grateful. My sponsor is Myers, and then it's just so good to be at a live conference. We've been doing, at first we were doing the Zoom thing, you know, and I remember somebody called one time and said, you know, can you speak at our group in April? And I'm like, we are not going to be talking on the computers in April, you know. And I mean, remember when we were flattening out the curve for 14 days and all that? I bought that, you know. But it's so funny to see the difference. You know, I go to live meetings now. We've been back live for a while. And I can't stop waving at people. You know, I've been in the little boxes so long. You know, Blind Dave is a member of our, he introduces himself. I found myself waving at Blind Dave the other day. I'm like, he can't see you, you know. I mean, it's funny. This has been my imitation of somebody at an AA meeting for the last 2 years ago. You know, sometimes you're like, dude, you got to be a little more subtle. You're creeping me out here a little bit, you know what I mean? I want to thank Jimmy. I'm a little nervous. Am I the only one that's nervous about Jimmy having a key to your room? Is that? I don't know. We'll see how that goes. But Jimmy works real hard to get any. You know, if you've been here before, you know, you start getting emails like Monday about, you know, next year. He does a great job of promoting this thing, and I joke, but I mean, there's a small group of people that can have a real effect on a community, and you know, and create what I call a pocket of enthusiasm. And AA, you know, Bob B says that pocket of enthusiasm is Charlie's code for people that are doing it right. But I mean, you know, maybe, you know, Katie and I love being here, and we've really been looking for this. I'm going to apologize for my voice up front. I've had throat issues for the last 10 years. In fact, right before we came for the first time in 2013, I'd had my first throat surgery. And I mean, if you guys can get through it, I'll get through the talk, but I'm probably not going to be hitting any high notes up here, you know. But it's just so good to see so many friends. I mean, Chad and Julie. Julie is from up here, Chad has moved. Julie was in Austin for a long time, and now Chad's been up here. But I put him in charge of my Sharpie. One of the tricks I'll tell you about these, when they have a single thing like that, is put your name on the back of it, and then when it flips over, we still know who you are, and we can act like, and we go, hey, old Bob, yeah, how you doing, Bob? Never forget you. I want to thank Jimmy. The last time we were here, I got a shaving kit from this conference, and I brought the old busted up one up here the next morning to show you how badly I needed a shaving kit. You got to see what they gave me this year. These socks are ridiculous, and I was like, I'm wearing them. But we got a lot of friends here, and we're seeing a lot of people, and that sort of thing. And I want to thank the taper, because that's a really big deal. I've got a couple of notes up here about what I'm going to talk about. But how am I doing, Katie? It's funny. I may just tell stories tonight. You know, first time we were ever going to do a workshop, Chris Schroeder sent us a thing and said, "I want you guys to do a workshop." And I'm like, "I don't know, man. I mean, I'm still kind of nervous about giving a one-hour talk. You know, and I mean, what are we going to talk about Friday night and all day Saturday and Sunday morning? And it's pretty scary, you know." And he says, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put together a little schedule for you." And he sends down this schedule and says, like, from 9 o'clock till 10 o'clock, Charlie does step one, and then from 10:30. And I swear to God, I looked at the thing, and my first thought was, "Oh, I'm going to need more time," you know. And we've been fighting over the microphone ever since. So, you'll hear a lot about the Katie and Charlie. You know, we were best friends for 20 years, and litter mates in AA, and then, hopefully we'll get around to some of that. You know, I'm supposed to be talking about step one tonight. I'll warn you in advance, there's times here in the talk where I'll say we're going to get back to that later. And what that means is that this ain't the appropriate time to tell that little chunk of the story. But when I tell you we're going to get back to it later, we're probably not coming back, you know. I got a little ADD working up here, but, you know, I'm an unapologetic big book guy. I love the big book. I love what it has done in my life. You know, the big book is a description of a program of action that will set people like us free. But what we're going to try to do this weekend is talk about our take on working the steps out of the big book. But, you know, because before Myers, my sponsor was a guy named Mark Houston. And I don't know if any of you have ever listened. If you don't hear me say anything else this weekend, hear me say, get a hold of some Mark Houston recordings and listen to them. He blew our minds. I mean, I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years sober, and I'd hit several. I hit a wall at 4.5 years. I hit a wall at 7 years. Hit a big wall at 17 years, and that's when I found out there was people doing this thing at a different level than I'd experienced before. And I went all over the place talking about that wall I hit at 17 years, like it was the last wall I was ever going to hit. Until Jimmy and I did Usual Suspects together, and I was in my 32nd year, and 32 years brought me to my knees. I had some fresh stuff to talk about at that conference. That was a wonderful conference, and I really enjoyed doing it with Jimmy. It was a men's conference down in Tennessee. But, you know, Mark used to say that given one of us, this is my current sponsor is a bookbinder. And all this is a large print copy of the big book. It's been leather bound, but I mean, right there on the cover title page is the first promise in the big book. It says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from what? From a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. We're going to talk about that and lots of other stuff, you know. But Mark used to say, giving me a copy of this book and expecting me to get it would be like giving me the flight manual to an F-16 fighter jet and saying, when you get through reading this, we got one out in the parking lot, you know, try not to hurt yourself or anybody else while you're flying. I really need some instruction. I need somebody showing me through this stuff. You know, because one of the other things Mark used to like to say was, if it was just God, the big book would be one page long. You know, it would say, God gets you sober, God keeps you sober, rock on, you know, and go help somebody. But so what we're going to, you know, let me just roll right into it. What makes AA a big deal is an understanding of three things. There were three things that came together when AA was created that made it a really big deal. And one was an understanding of the problem with alcoholism, because if I don't understand the problem, we're not going to go very far. I'm certainly not going to be interested in a solution or a problem I don't think I have. The second thing that was important was a solution for the problem. And then, but, you know, I sometimes compare it to if I went outside and my car wouldn't start, and let's say I don't know anything about cars, and I'm turning the key and nothing's happening, and then Chad comes out and goes, "Oh, you left your headlights on," because I don't know what the problem is, right? He comes out and says, "You left your headlights on, you have a dead battery." Okay, now I know what the problem is, right? Am I going anywhere? No, because I need a solution to the problem. And the solution is we got to get some juice in that battery. But now I know this, I still don't have I'm not going anywhere until you give me a program of action that will bring about the solution to my problem. And, you know, and so if he says, you know, raise your hood, I'm going to bring jumper cables over, put red on red, black on black, I'll rev my engine when I tell you. You go, now we got a program of action that'll bring about a solution to my problem. And that's what happened in AA. And so, you know, problem, solution, program of action. And it's beautifully laid out in our book. I'm going to go ahead and, in AA, we talk about coming out of our own experience. And that's what started AA. That's the most important thing is one alcoholic sharing their experience. And there's a joke I like to tell about that. And it's, some of you have heard this joke before. Some of you have heard me tell this joke before. But it's a good joke, and I like the way I tell it. So, and it's about this guy. He's driving along one day, and he passes by this farmhouse, and there's a sign out front that says, talking dog for sale. And he can't stand it. He goes up to the farmhouse, and he goes, so you got a talking dog? And the guy goes, yeah, he's around back. And he wanders around back, and there's this red hound dog laying there, and he looks at the dog, and he goes, so you can talk? The dog goes, well, I certainly can. He goes, my God, how did that happen? He goes, well, it's actually a very interesting story. So when I was young, I started picking up language skills from the humans that I interacted with. And over time, I started working with slang and colloquialisms and local phrases. And it's really made for a very interesting life for me. So I had a 19-year career in the Drug Enforcement Administration. I was able to infiltrate some scenes that no human agent would have ever gotten into. He says, but, you know, I've traveled the world. I've eaten the cooking of some of the greatest chefs, stayed in some of the finest hotels. But really enough about me, he said, even more interesting than me, some of my pups have developed foreign language skills. And I have two pups that are in the United Nations building right now as international diplomats. And the guy goes, my God, it's just been fascinating talking to you. And he goes back up front where there's farmers sitting there, and he goes, man, how much do you want for that dog? The farmer goes, I don't know, $40? And he's like, why would you sell a fabulous dog like that for $40? And the farmer thinks for a minute and goes, oh, none of that crap he told you is true. You know, I mean, it's kind of like that around here. You know, it doesn't really matter how good the story is if it's not my experience. So you know, we talk about depth and weight and that sort of thing. And we're going to, you know, it talks about that on Roman numeral 28. It says, the message which can interest and hold the alcoholic must have depth and weight. And so anyway, what I'm going to try to do tonight is lay out the problem, you know, because when we talk about problem, solution, program of action, and the book is full of stories and instances where they had two out of three of those things, you know, like, and I'll get it right. But, you know, on page 20, it says, doubtless you're curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. I want to talk about one thing for a minute. You know, in the book, it says we this, we that. You know who we is? In the foreword to the first edition, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So when it says, the book is written from their perspective as people who have experienced the program of recovery, when they're saying, and one of my favorite examples is in those nine-step promises when they go, are these extravagant promises? You know, and they're saying, well, we think not. Now, you know, there's times when I want to go, darn right, those are extravagant promises. When I'm the new guy with a brand new big book in my hand, you know, when we got him out there chanting, you know, like, we think not. And you're like, oh, really? And so fear of people and you know, it's just gone, you know, but they're saying, we think not. Because we're on the other side. We've had this experience. We've worked this way. And we're telling you what we did. So, you know, when they say on page 20, it says, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. My first job when I sit down with a new guy, I say guys because I work with guys. I'm way underqualified to work with women. I work with guys. It's funny, one time, I've never told this story before. One time I was talking to Katie and I said, you know, Katie, you hear a lot of inventory from my guys, you know, Chad, and a lot of my guys will do inventory with Katie, and she's the best at hearing inventory. of anybody I've ever seen. And she goes, I mean, I bet she hears 12 hours of inventory a week. It's incredible to watch. But she goes, yeah. And I go, I don't get the impression that I'm going to hear inventory from many of your girls. And she goes, absolutely not. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a double standard, don't you think? She goes, oh, honey, there's a lot of double standards. You know, I mean, the sooner you get comfortable with that, the happier you're going to be. You know, I mean, but first thing I do when I sit down with the new guys is give them what I call a fatal dose of alcoholism or a step one experience, you know, because sometimes I think we can rush a guy in without, you know, like you hear stuff like, well, I'll get around to that in a minute. But, you know, if we don't always know what the deal is when we get here. And a lot of stuff I'm going to talk about, I certainly didn't know when I got to AA. I've learned that stuff since I get here. But one thing that is interesting to me, if you gave everybody that comes to AA a flag to wave, everybody's flag would say the same thing. It would say, you don't understand. My case is different. You don't understand. My case is different. If you understood, I know that stuff might work for you guys, but if you understood how complex and complicated my situation is and what's happened to me or maybe what didn't happen to me, well, frankly, you'd be a little bit embarrassed, you know, to be offering me your hinky little 12-step thing. Because I'm acting like the steps are on the wall back here, but imaginary steps back here. But I don't know anybody that's ever walked in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, looked up and read those steps on the wall and gone, that ought to do it, you know. You know, it's like, do you have an advanced course or anything like that? But when we talk about this, one of my favorite guys in the Big Book is Fred. And, you know, y'all know about Fred. I love Fred. You know, it talks about, you know, that he was a likable personality, good family. I always say I had a lot in common with Fred, except for the job and the wife and the kids and the likable personality. And but I mean, when they went to see Fred in the hospital, they went to a couple of our recovered members went to see Fred in the hospital, and on page 42 it says they laid out the problem for him. It says they cited dozens of cases out of their own experience. Now why would they do that? Why would they go to see this guy in the hospital and cite dozens of cases out of their own experience? Well, it goes on to say, this process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. That's what we're trying to do with the step one experience, and you see guys have it all the time, you know, because in the treatment centers at home, there were some that would say, well, you know, you worked the first step getting here. Anybody heard that? All right, I even heard one where they said you worked the first three steps getting here, and I'm like, well, I mean, it wasn't Dr. Bob's experience. In the foreword of the second edition, it says he had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. He'd been in the Oxford movement for over 2 years, and you know, he even had a program of action, but he didn't understand the problem. You know, this is one where he knew he had a program of action, and he sensed that a spiritual remedy to his problem would help, but he didn't fully understand what it meant to be alcoholic. Because when Bill came to see him, it says when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he'd never been able to muster. And he sobered up never to drink again till the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another alcoholic as no non-alcoholic could. This is one of my favorite pieces of AA, is this identification. There are people you meet, you know, that you can meet them from across the room. And you're like, in fact, my biggest compliment when I meet somebody in AA now is when I go, I'll tell Katie later, I go, oh, I believe I'd have drank with that guy. You know, I mean, there's a certain, you know, bond in this identification. It speaks to what we call singleness of purpose and why AA is a one-trick pony. We're alcoholics working with alcoholics. Now, you can be alcoholic and anything else, but one of the reasons, you know, this is identification. And, on page 18, it says, what does it say? It says, highly psychiatrists who've dealt with us found it impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation. We're the only group of people I know that would go pay a psychiatrist $200 an hour and lie to him the whole time, you know? I mean, it's like if they go, "Do you drink, Mr. Parker?" And you're like, "Well, I, you know, might have a couple of beers, you know, if I'm mowing the yard or something, you know, like I've mowed the yard lately, you know." and it says, but wives, parents, and close friends find it even more difficult than do the doctor. And then it goes into the squiggly writing where it says, but the ex-problem drinker who's found our solution, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of the new guy in a couple hours. And it's so important. Well, it goes on to say, until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. What they say? They say, until this identification where I can tell Jimmy drank like I did, and the beautiful thing about it is if I can tell Danny drank like I did and he's not doing it anymore, I might just say, tell me what to do, and I'm willing to take action that I don't even believe in yet, because I can tell that this isn't some counselor or social worker that's talking to me. This is somebody, like Dr. Bob said about Bill, he knows the game. You know, he understood the game, and the 15-minute talk turned into 5 hours. But, I mean, one of the ways to tell how important an identification is when it's not there. I went to treatment around Christmas time, 1983, and I'll never forget it. It was right, like, it may have been Christmas, I don't know, but I mean, it was right around Christmas, and this group, we're having a big Christmas Day meal. I'm a big boy now. I was considerably heavier back then, and just to say that I was very interested in this Christmas lunch that they had, you know, and it was turkey and dressing and, but, you know, rolls and giblet gravy and cranberry sauce and, you know, and I mean, I got my plate and I'm just about to sit down and these double doors swing open and in walks five people. There's a group of do-gooders from one of the local churches and they've come to sing Christmas carols to us heathen alcoholics, right? Can you sense my excitement? You know, I mean, because now it's like, oh, boy, we don't get to eat now, you know. And I'm watching this lady's going around, and she says something to this lady. She says something to this guy, and then she says something to this guy. And when she gets to me, she says, "Are you a patient here?" And I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "I know exactly what you're going through." I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yes. I was once addicted to caffeine." I'm like, boy, ain't that a bitch. Yeah, that's... Let me ask you something. Do you ever pawn your mom's sterling silver to go get a can of Folgers? You know, I mean, bless her heart. You know, she was trying to identify, but you're like, no, that's not there. You know, but if Silkworth's definition was so helpful to Bob that day, let's talk about what he said on page 30. And another one where he talks about that. It says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we are alcoholic. It says it was the first step in recovery. And, you know, I don't always, sometimes I introduce myself as a recovered alcoholic. Not always. A lot of times I just say I'm alcoholic and then I'll circle back around to saying I've been granted the greatest gift that God can give an alcoholic of my variety, and that's recovery from this hopeless state of mind and body that the Big Book talks about. Because a lot of times if I get up and go, "I'm Charlie, I'm a recovered alcoholic," you can turn off my exact target audience, you know, the people I'm wanting to talk to are going to always one of those, you know. And so if we're talking, you know, one of the things we like to say is don't let anybody read your Big Book for you. I mean, I don't care whether you say recovered or recovering or whatever. One of the things that's amusing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that whenever we form a firing squad, we always form a circle. You know, and we got some of our best members picking each other off over whether it's sponsee or protege or twofold illness or threefold illness or recovered or recovering. But the main thing I would say is don't let anybody read your Big Book for you. You know, and if you have a firm belief, ask yourself, where did it come from and is it consistent with our literature? And then, you know, rock on. Because one of the reasons we work with the set-aside prayer is a prayer that's become popular. It used to be pretty obscure, but it basically is asking me to set aside what I think I know, because sometimes, a lot of times, what I think I know can stand in the way of a new experience. And hopefully we'll get around to talking about this confirmation bias, because a lot of times I would read the book and I wasn't looking for new information. I was looking for confirmation of ways I was already right. And this probably doesn't happen in New Jersey, but I would, but I'd read the book and I'd be like, Oh yeah, Jay Walker. Yeah, look at that. And then, you know, I'm like, look, you can't tell me anything about this. I've already got it highlighted and underlined. You know, I mean, I know that paragraph. You know, and do you ever hear something really heavy out of the book? You go, man, I got to mark that in my book. And you open it up and you go, well, it's already highlighted and underlined. You know. Thought that was the first time I'd ever heard it, you know. But I mean, you know, if we're talking about having recovered, I got to get moving because what do I have, about an hour and a half left, Kitty? If we're talking about having recovered, what are we talking about recovering from? And right, Roman numeral 28 in the big book, it talks about, it turns out that as an alcoholic, I have two problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I'm drinking it. The other one happens to me when I'm not drinking it. Other than that, I don't struggle with alcohol. So glad to hear you all laugh at that, you know, because sometimes I said that out at the treatment center one time and they looked at me and they're like, when do we smoke? You know, I mean, you know. but the first piece of alcoholism is what happens to me when I drink it. And it's a physical reaction to alcohol, and it calls it this physical actually, the phenomenon of craving, you know, and it says, well, it's just, did I have that written down? It's so much easier when it's on the notes. You know, when it says, we believe, here it is, because in the foreword of the door, it talks about, and then it turns out that we are bodily and mentally different from our fellows. You know, I don't really like it, but, the, you know, there's three things, they give three tests for alcoholism in the book. One is to step across the street to a bar room, try some controlled drinking. Don't recommend that one. And then the other one, it says try to quit for a period of time and see how it goes. And then the last one, it says study this book. That's all over this book. Every chapter in our book says read this book, whether it's talking to employers, to wives, the family afterward. It always says read this book, read this book, read this book. You know, and the last thing Silkworth said in his thing was, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book. You know, and so Roman numeral 28 is a super heavy page, and we spend a lot of time on that XXVIII, which is a mouthful. But when we talk about it, where'd it go? I've got glasses. Hallelujah! Wow, look at that. It says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. I like to break this down because none of this made sense to me on the way here, and a lot of it I've learned about since I got here. But when it talks about, it says action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics. So we're not talking about everybody that drinks. We're talking about chronic alcoholics. And it says it's the manifestation of an allergy. So the manifestation of an allergy for our purpose is just an abnormal physical reaction. When me in the front row get a bushel of strawberries and we start eating strawberries, but all of a sudden I start going, and then, you know, my airway swells shut and I fall out on the floor, you know, you'd say, this guy's got an abnormal physical reaction to strawberries. And the way it manifests just means the way it shows up. So the way that allergy to strawberries manifests is in that, you know, turning blue and anaphylactic shock. How does my allergy to alcohol show up? And it calls it this phenomenon of craving. Now, the thing with, and what it's telling me is that when I take a drink, something happens that ain't regular. It doesn't happen to my sister. It doesn't happen to about 90% of the population. Only about 10% of the population even has the capacity to become alcoholic because of this phenomenon of craving. Now the tricky thing, so when I take a drink, it triggers a craving for more booze. And the most important thing you can do with anything I say about this stuff or anything the book says about it is lay it up against your experience and see if it's a fit. Is this what happens to me? Is this my experience looking over the past? And you know, I start drinking. And it's just, in this statement, it says, in this statement, Dr. Silkworth confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. See, they used to think it was a moral issue or that sort of thing, but now you say, no, there's a physical aspect to alcoholism. And it didn't satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were full flat from reality, or were outright mental defectives. But it says this idea of an allergy interests us, explains many things. You know, because if you're like me, by the time I got to AA, it wasn't the first time the topic of how loaded Charlie gets had been brought up. You know, I mean, it's like people have been talking to me about my drinking for a minute, you know. And, you know, it's funny because, and we act like everybody knows this stuff on our way to AA, or sometimes we sit in AA and think everybody out there knows about this stuff and they're just choosing not to come to AA. I had no idea that AA was going to be the answer to my problems. I mean, it would have never occurred to me if the maintenance man in my apartment, in my friend's apartment that I was laying up in his apartment, if he hadn't been to AA, I would have never even thought about going, you know, But think about it. Remember when you would promise people that you're not going to drink again and you really meant it, and then they look up a minute and you're drinking again? And they'd ask us that question. They'd say, why'd you start drinking again? And we give them the only answer we got, which is what? That's music. I've said that in rooms with 6,500 people, and it's like a chorus that we just go, I don't know. God Almighty, I don't know. It's just what I do. I make promises, and I break them. I hurt the people I love. And so by the time I get here, I'm thinking, disease my eye, there's something bad wrong with me, because when I'm saying I don't want to drink again, I mean it, and then I drink again. And, you know, and so... But the tricky thing about this phenomenon of craving is I never thought I'd triggered a phenomenon of craving when I started drinking. I just thought I'd changed my mind, right? You know, anyway, you're going, I'm just going to go have a couple tonight. I'm not going to go crazy. We're not going to, you know, certainly, I promise you, I used to drink a little place in East. I grew up in Dallas. I live in Austin now. I've been in Austin since 77, but I used to drink at this place and called the Spillway Pub. It's a wonderful little place. And I promise you, I never one time walked into the Spillway Pub and leaned up against the bar and went, oh, Bobby, God Almighty, the spiritual malady is on me today. You know, and I had a beer on the way over here and it has triggered a phenomenon of craving, you know, that... I mean, nobody talks like that. This is stuff we learn, you know, after we've been here for a minute, you know. But, I mean, it triggers. But, you know, I would think I changed my mind, you know. Because I'd have one, and I go, you know, I know I said I was only going to have a couple. It turns out two's a bad number, you know. I think I'll have seven, you know. Seven's a good number. But whatever it is, I always have a new plan and a new plan and a new plan. It's like, you know, y'all go ahead. I'll meet you at dinner or I'll catch up with you a minute. But I don't always go, I'm going to stay here and blow my whole paycheck. But I'm always changing my plan a little bit. And, you know, and so and it gets so bad. So baffling. Silkworth, I'm looking forward to going to Silkworth's grave again. Because he really helped us. Because he's the one that came out with a lot of this physical aspect of alcoholism. And he says, there are many situations that arise out of the phenomenon of craving to cause men to make the ultimate sacrifice rather than continue to fight. You know what that's saying? That's saying there are guys that will kill themselves rather than keep trying to do this deal because they can't figure out why they swear to God they're not going to drink again, and they drink again. And, you know, and back to Roman numeral 28. I got to get going. I've only got about an hour and a half left here. Okay. How am I doing, Katie? I think I'm going pretty good. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Any argument on that one? You know, I mean, I think it's a little understated, you know. I mean, it's like, I like banana pudding, you know, but I love the effect produced by alcohol. The first time I ever got loaded, I remember thinking, oh, we're going to do this a lot, you know. And, you know, from that point on, anything that got between me and drinking was going to get moved out of the way. And I didn't know that was the deal, but that was the deal. You know, and it's, so it says, the sensation is so elusive that they cannot, after a while, differentiate the truth from the false. I'm in my seventh treatment center thinking I can tweak this deal a little bit. I know it looks bad. You know, I was on a bad run. I had a little bad luck there. You know, and that's probably why I'm, you know, it's a big overreaction to park me in this treatment center. And if I ever get as lame as these other guys, I might try your little thing. But when I get out of here, I think I can tweak this deal. Tweak meant something different back then for some of our younger members. But I mean, I always think I can just adjust it a little bit. And but I mean, when it says their alcoholic life seems the only normal one, I love that one because my sainted 99-year-old mother, who's still lives by, I just saw her this week. She still lives by herself in a 3,600 square foot house. My mom, she'll be 100 in February, but she was a first grade school teacher for 42 years, and she used to move just this one finger when she would talk to me, and she would go, not the wrist, not the arm, just that finger. And she would say, you are such an idiot. You drink every day. And I remember thinking internally, Mom, everybody I know drinks every day. And truth is, if alcohol did for you what it does for me, you'd be stupid not to drink every day. I mean, why am I going to take a day off from that? And the other thing she didn't know was what happens to me when I don't drink. But we'll get back around to that. But when it says my alcoholic life seems the only normal, I got a new stat I've been working with. This is going to blow your mind. I love this one. Did you know that most people are born, live their whole lives, and die without ever being arrested? I know. It's like, what? Yeah. I mean, if I called up my mom and said, oh, Mom, I can't come over. I got to go see my PO and give a UA because I got a DUI. She'd have no idea what I'm talking about. And here we're like, oh, that sucks, man. You know, who's your PO? You know, I mean, how much time you got? You know, I mean, my alcoholic life seems like, and because I don't go from the way I was drinking when I was 16 to the way I was when I came into AA, it's just like that. It happens in little ticks over a period of time. Tick, 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 tick. And by the time I get to AA, today looks a lot like yesterday, and yesterday looks a lot like last week. And I start doing things over that period of time to compromise my principles and doing things that I didn't think I would ever do. And I don't really see it happening, but, you know, after years of watching people drink in sobriety, not only do we not think like they do, they don't think like we, they also don't drink like we do. I mean, I went to the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally 10 years in a row. I used to go to Mardi Gras. Even there, they don't drink like we do. You know, I thought everybody was just getting smashed, and even at Sturgis, it was rare to see somebody just knee walking drunk, you know, and that was my goal, you know. I mean, it was about it. So we could talk a lot about what happens when I drink that triggers this craving, but here's where it really gets tricky. And because when my mom would say, "You need to stop drinking," the thing I didn't know to tell her is that if I didn't, from where you're sitting, then he looks like a good boy when he's not drinking. If he just wouldn't drink, he's a good boy. But they don't understand what happens to me when I stop drinking. And that's the second piece of alcoholism. And, you know, over on page 23, it says these observations. What observations? All these observations we've been making about what happens when we drink wouldn't mean squat. I think it says would be academic and pointless, but it means it wouldn't mean squat. It wouldn't matter what happens to me when I drink vodka if I didn't take that first drink. That's something I didn't think about. It says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. Why? How? Well, this physical allergy is a big problem, what happens, but it's not my biggest problem. Because if my biggest problem is what happens when I drink 4 ounces of vodka, my solution would be real simple. Just be knock it off, right? Don't do that anymore. But you know, here we're going back to Roman numeral 28. It says I don't get too comfortable. I get a little, am I the only one that gets a little uncomfortable? A week or two without a drink, you know, says I get restless. You know, I mean, I don't really like the way my clothes are touching me, and I get irritable. Now, irritable is a tricky one, because irritable is kind of uncool. Right? I don't want to be described as irritable, you know, but it's not my fault if I become keenly aware of how stupid everybody else is. You know, and after a minute, you know, I'm like, my boss is an idiot, and this guy is a moron. And I think that guy that just gave me a look, and then the guy at the grocery store has got 14 items on the 10-item lane. And the reason I know it is because I counted every flipping one of them, you know. And on the wrong day, I'm the guy that's going to go like, so, pal, which four of those items do you want to put back, you know. And if he comes back with the wrong answer, it's a bad day at the grocery store, you know, and now I got to explain to my family how I got arrested going to get milk, you know, but it's like, by God, there is chaos in society and somebody's got to do something about it. And if not me, who, you know? But here's the other thing I've learned in inventory. I'm also a hypocrite and I like double standards. So don't step to me when I got 14 items, because I got a story to go with it. This is all over our inventory process. It's, you know, when Chad fouls up, it's an outrage. But when I screw up, I got a story to go with it, you know. And it's always, well, you know, it happens a lot. But I get restless, irritable, discontented, unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks I see others taking with impunity. You know what impunity means? It means they don't get punished for it. They can have a couple of drinks, and it doesn't cost them their job and their girlfriend and their car and all the values they grew up with and that sort of thing. And when I get just uncomfortable enough, I start wanting to know, where's mine? How come he gets to have a couple of pops and I don't? And so it says there's – well, so somewhere along the line, I lose the power of choice and control over my drinking. On page 24, it says, we passed into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Isn't that interesting? We all know the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. A desire to stop drinking will get me a front row seat in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. But it says right there on page 24, it won't do a darn thing to keep me sober. It says, I pass it into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. I've lost the power of choice and control. And somewhere along the line, good God. Going good, honey. Have I told you how much I love Katie? Yeah. The way I talk about losing the power of choice and control, though, is the pawn shops. I loved pawn shops. Any other pawn shoppers here tonight? Oh, boy, one really hesitant hand over here. I loved everything about the pawn shops, almost everything. I didn't like the interest rate too much. But I loved the purity of the equation. You know, you could go in there. I never went into a pawn shop and had them go, good God, man. Weren't you just here this morning, you know, or what are you going to do with this money? You know, it was just like you give them the deer rifle and they give you the money, and then you give them the shotgun and they give you the money. And so, and I had a plan, and we alcoholics, we make some good plans. We do. We make plans that work, that you could take over to Rutgers and they look it over and go, that's a pretty solid plan. You know, I mean, and our plans work right up till they quit working, you know. And my plan was that I had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop, and I could usually do some kind of a deal or pull some kind of a scam that would get everything out of the pawn shop. We could keep this ball rolling. But a big piece of the equation was that I didn't own very much stuff. So I was having to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that puts a little extra heat on the equation, but it's still manageable. We still got a plan, you know, and that sort of thing. But I mean, you know, but one time I pulled a little insurance scam, and I I got enough money to get everything out of the pawn shop, but it's also really important to go by the Spillway Pub and settle my tab. It was the only bar in Dallas that would let me run a tab, and it was really important to have that once this money's gone. So I'm just going to go by and settle my tab. We're not going to trigger the phenomenon of craving or anything, but and then we're going to go to the pawn shop and pick everything up. Well, I'm a blackout drinker, and I blacked out a lot. I mean, oblivion was always my goal. In fact, there's only one or two lines in this book that don't really apply to me. And one of them is it says, our stories are filled with countless vain attempts to prove that we can drink like normal men. I don't have any experience with that. I never really took great efforts to drink like normal men. I only tried it a couple of times. But I was about oblivion from the very, but this day, I go by to get everything out of the pawn shop, and next thing you know, I come out of a five-day blackout. I didn't have a lot of those. I had a lot of those blackouts where you don't remember the drive home, or you have to look through the curtains to see if the car's in the driveway, or, you know, why are there weeds in the bumper? And, you know, and that's right. But this was 5 days of don't remember anything, and I'll never forget it. I came out of this blackout on the edge of the bed at my mother's house. You know, like any good gangster, we always wind up back at mom's house, you know, but I'm sitting on the edge of the bed, and I could still describe the entire room to you, because I passed out with my clothes on, and in my right hand pocket I had $8, and in my left hand pocket I still had all those pawn tickets. And we've all had those mornings where you're just going, oh no, because now I don't feel very good. And I'm out of plan, and I got nothing. I shot my wad on this other scam, and I got nothing, and I got nothing. And I'm a lot of things. I'm not a sociopath. I'm worried about it there for a while, but I'm not. I've studied what it means to be a sociopath. I'm not selling my dad's shotgun for $40 and not, you know, feeling bad about it. And so I would have to go to my father, who's a good man, and say, Dad, listen, if we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff, you know. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail, you know. And are there any Al-Anons here tonight? If we have to say that like it's funny, we know that ain't funny. But if I touch the desperation of that day, going to my dad and telling him the best I could do was for him to take me around to go get. So I've just come apart up here. I'm not able to cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here anyway, but we would have to get into my dad's pickup truck and go. Dallas is a big spread out town like Los Angeles. So it wasn't just good to go to the pawn shop. It's like, we got to go up on East Grand and get your shotgun, and we got to go out on Buckner Boulevard and get your deer rifle, and your sterling silver is in Oak Cliff, and the metal detectors are over on Garland Road. So it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And when we'd be driving along, I'd be going, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. I don't want to feel like this. I don't want you to feel like this. I will never do this again. And if I was lying to that man, I darn sure didn't know it, because it felt like I meant it with every fiber of my being. But Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people that can make up their mind to stop drinking and pull it off. AA is for guys like me that swear to God I'm never going to drink again, and I drink again, and I drink again, and I drink again. And, you know, so by the time I got to you people, we'd go get everything out of the pawn shop, and within 3 days I'd hit the back door of his house like a cat burglar and just be like, that, and then off we'd go. And I went to, my father and I made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times before I got, that's the guy I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how slick I was. That's how cool I was. I was a burden to anyone that was unfortunate enough to love me or be associated with me. And that's the guy I brought. I could not, because what I didn't know when we were driving around in that truck, is that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. when I talk about not unmanageability, I'm talking about not being able to manage the decision to stop drinking when I really want to. Because when I was telling him I'm never going to do that again, it'd be like telling you people I could flap my arms and fly around this room. I did not have the power to do it. So going back to this doctor's opinion, it says after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree. How do we come out of a run? It says emerging remorseful with a firm resolution never to drink again. And it says this is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. We get into this terrible cycle of alcoholism where I drink and I trigger the craving and now I'm about drinking. And I drink until I have to stop or I get stopped. Now I'm not drinking and I'm starting to feel a little better, you know, and maybe she's not going to leave and maybe they're not going to fire me and maybe I'm back in the big bed. I got a little fold of money in my pocket, but after a minute I start getting restless, start getting irritable, I start getting discontented and I get so uncomfortable that the obsession to drink gets back on me until I'm powerless overtaking that first drink. So I drink until I have to stop and I stop until I have to drink. And I drink until I have to stop, and I stop until I have to drink. And I tell the guys all the time, don't ever say it can't get any worse. That just shows a lack of imagination, you know, because there's always a bottom below the bottom I know. You know, I mean, it gets worse. And you might look up, you know, and go, man, I wish I'd quit drinking back in 2022 when it was still going okay. You know, and that's this terrible cycle of alcoholism. And that's what the book means by this hopeless condition of mind and body. And it says, unless this person can experience a psychic change. The book describes it about five different ways. It calls it a psychic change. It calls it a spiritual experience. It calls it spiritual awakening. It calls it a personality change sufficient to overcome drinking. But whatever it is, something big has got to happen for a drunk like me to stop drinking for 30 minutes, much less 37 years. You know, and so given this step one experience, step one just drives everything. And the importance of step one is it's so important to take some time with a new person and let them really know. Because when it says, if you want what we have, and they don't even know, they don't know what we have, they don't even know what they have. And sometimes to be able to break down to them what we really mean by a hopeless state of mind and body, I see guys have this step one experience all the time. I'm in the construction business. I'm not in the treatment business, but I talk at treatment centers, and I see these guys go in, and you see them lean forward and go, hold on just a minute. I've been in and out of AA for 18 years, and I've never heard the stuff you're talking about. It explains a lot of stuff I've never been able to explain before. It explains why when I start drinking, it always gets away from me. And explains why every time I stop, I always start again. And so what happens is, in the face of that real, when that powerlessness hits right here, there's a surrender that takes place where you can see them go, my God, man, if I got it the way you're describing it, I got no shot. I'm not going to get out of here and manage this thing or anything. But tied to that surrender is a willingness to go into the rest of the work. Step one is like a ski jump that catapults me into the rest of the work. And, you know, Katie's going to talk about step two, but it says, we in our turn sought the same escape with the desperation of drowning men. You know what? My experience has been that the more firmly you plant the powerlessness of step one in somebody, the less work you have to do in step two. Because when it says that, you know what's cool about working with drowning men? They don't ask a lot of questions. Because before I used to think, I need you to tell me what we're going to do, how's it going to go, what's it going to feel like while we're doing it, what's the final result going to be? And I thought it was really important that I approve of the whole process. You know, but when I'm a drowning man, I'm just going to, just help me. It's not like I'm going to go, pardon me, before we proceed, how much experience do you have helping drowning men? You know, or is this your only boat? I don't care for blue boats typically, but you know, and then it goes on to say that what seemed like a flimsy reed. Now imagine if you're drowning and all there is to try to grab hold of is a little flimsy reed, and it says what seemed at first to be a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. We're going to get into that, but it says for one of my, I don't want to step on your quotes. Oh, she said good. Are you going to talk about page 34, those who are unable to drink moderately?
No.
On page 34, it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. Whether or not one can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. And then one of my favorite lines after that says, we're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. You know, it's like, if you're not trying to quit, then rock on. But, you know, whatever we call this spiritual experience, it's not going to be interesting to me if I still think that my power will get the job done. I don't know why I would give a flip about a power greater than myself if I still think my power is going to get the job done. But the moment that I have this crushing awareness that I got no shot, I get real flexible on what the power is going to look like. And you know, one of the things Mark used to say was, if you're a gangster out there, you got to be a gang. If you're a warrior out there, you got to be a warrior for recovery in here. Because sometimes we get out there and you know, I'm a badass out there, but then I want to work a candy-ass little program. I shouldn't be talking like that. But you know, but it's like, you know, because sometimes after a while, I start acting like I'm almost powerless over alcohol. And if I'm almost powerless over alcohol, I don't have to do all of these disciplines and that sort of thing. But that's why with Fred, when it says they snuffed out the last flicker of conviction, and he could do the job himself. I mean, so Katie's going to talk about step two. We leave it wide open in step two, but I mean, I love talking about step one, and I really think it's worth taking the time to pound it into somebody so they can have this experience. Because if we just assume that everybody is alcoholic and knows what we're talking about and everything, and throw the doors wide open, it kind of funnels down into nothing. But if we tighten up the opening a little bit and establish what it really means to be alcoholic, it opens up into everything. It opens up into the power and presence of this power I'm only going to seek when I'm driven by this powerlessness to do the work behind that powerlessness and that surrender. Thanks a lot, and we're going to take a little break. We're going to take a 15-minute break and come back in here. That was 57 minutes.